Good morning, honorable members. I think we supposed to start our portfolio committee meeting of public enterprise, and the time now is 10, and I wish to take this opportunity to welcome all the members.
Recording in progress.
Including our invited guest and anybody who is part of our session, including the staff. Welcome you all. Honorable members, I think we today have to get a briefing from the department, the treasury, on the impediments that have policy effects on the department or on the state-owned entities. We also have to get the treasury. I think we all have received the presentation. Also, I think the other one is the Department of Public Enterprise Secretary from, the Department of
State and Industry Corporation.
Okay.
Trade, Industry and Cooperation and Competition.
Oh, okay. Trade, Industry and Cooperation. Thank you. Without wasting time, can we go to the apologies first?
Good morning, Chair and honorable members and guests. I have received apologies from members of Parliament. It's Ms. Tshabalala won't be able to join the meeting today. And then from the departments, both the minister and the deputy minister will not be able to join us. However, the senior officials within the departments are leading the presentation for both the DTI and National Treasury. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I'm just checking here also the officials that are here, okay. Without wasting time, therefore, I want first to upfrontly propose to those who will be making presentations that due to the time constraints, because today we've got a couple of activities that will be taking place in the National Parliament, and some among us are supposed to be participating, some directly, some through visual. Therefore, I will request that the presentations that we'll get, each and every person making presentation, just take 20 to 30 minutes as a maximum, so that we also give an opportunity to the members to be able to engage the presentation. Without wasting time, I think we'll have to get from the department first, in the absence of the minister and the deputy minister. Can the DG, if he's present, to just give an overview?
Chair?
Hello?
The National Treasury,
yes,
will start.
Okay.
They are led by Ms. Estelle Sitton.
Okay, but telling me that there is no one from the department to give an overview, I mean, from the Department of Public Enterprise. before we give it to our invitees?
Not necessarily, Chairperson. I think DPEs, they are just here as observers. The two participants is DTI and National Treasury.
Okay, but they were supposed to say something. But it's fine then. Let's kick it therefore to the treasurer.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee. I am Estelle Sitan from the National Treasury's Office of the Chief Procurement Officer. With me this morning, I have two of my colleagues, Umeza Tokwe, as well as Leander Peterson. The other members of the OCPO is engaged in another portfolio committee for small business enterprises. So I will be leading the discussions and my colleagues will support me with any clarity or any questions that the members might have. Okay, thank you, Chair. I assume that the members can see the presentation. I will go through, thank you. I will go through the presentation as concisely as possible. We saw the presentation that the Department of Public Enterprises did to the committee. And in this presentation, we are attempting to
I was just Ms. Sitan, I've made you a co-host, so you may share the presentation. It's not possible yet.
Let me just try that again, Chair, because it shows on my side that it's showing. Let's do this.
That's better.
Okay. Can you see it now?
Yes, ma'am. If I see it, I assume that everybody sees.
Okay. So we will be attempting to answer some of these challenges that they have provided us. The first challenge that they presented was the requirement for National Treasury to approve all contract variations or amendments in terms of Instruction 3. They are saying that the approval of these variations by NT should be done away with, and as it has contributed to marked increases in irregular expenditure. And some contracts that have expired due to the delays in the process, and that this has an impact on SOC's operations. Ultimately, the accounting authority is accountable for these transactions, whether it's supported by NT or not. Their proposal is that the responsibility should reside with the respective SOC's accounting authorities, and that quarterly reporting should be done to NT. So what we are responding to this is just to make the committee aware of the new supply chain management instruction at number 3 of 2021-2022, which came into effect on the 1st of April, which in essence repealed the old instruction of 2016-2017. And in this instruction, the power to approve procurement by other means, that is deviations from inviting competitive bids. Inviting bids from, or deviations from inviting competitive bids is once again vested with accounting officers and not the relevant treasury as it was previously required. So the chairman by other means, to the Treasury and to the Auditor General. They reported within 14 days after the finalization of the procurement, as well as on expansions and variations. That would be a monthly report. And then both of these requirements must be reported in the annual reports. The intention, members, of this reporting requirement is for Treasury and ACSA to immediately pick up glaring matters of non-compliance. The idea is to provide for transparency with the belief that early detection can assist us with intervention where we see it may need assistance, or where we need to intervene before it goes too far. The second challenge that they presented to us, again, relates to deviations from competitive bids. The same paragraph 8 of instruction note 3, where they again say the challenge is for when NT needs to approve these deviations, and the use of OEMs to install and maintain equipment, the use of fully owned subsidiaries, and the use of organs of state such as the CSIR. Their proposal was that these responsibilities should reside with the respective accounting authorities. Again, the list of deviations must be submitted to the National Treasury, and quarterly reports would be submitted. The National Treasury's response, again, would be to refer back to the new instruction note instruction note 3 of 2021, which refer the accountability back to the accounting officers to make those decisions. In the case of the use of wholly owned subsidiaries and the use of government or other organs of states, such as the CSIR, is currently, in terms of the PFMA, means that contracting for the provisions of goods and services must be in accordance with the Constitution and the SEM framework, where these goods and services are both provided by the private and the public sector. It is fair then to open it to an open competitive bidding process. Where goods and services can be provided by an organ of state only, or where there is only a single supplier in both the public and the private sector, the state organ may depart from a competitive bidding process and deviate in terms of instruction note 3, the new instruction note. If there is sufficient justification for this deviation, and in which case the deviation approval should then be followed and approved by the accounting authority. Organs of state may not act outside of the Constitution and the legislative framework to favor government institutions or entities on the exclusive basis that they are government entities. If an organ of state has a specific mandate to provide certain goods and services, such as CETA, according to the CETA legislation, then the process provided for in that institution's legislation is then followed. The third challenge, members of the committee, was the requirement for NT to approve supplier restriction process in terms of paragraph 7.4 of instruction note 3, 2016-17. Their challenge was that only NT can restrict suppliers, and the ability of SOCs to restrict suppliers who have compromised procurement systems prior to NT approval adds to timelines. The proposal is for SOCs to be able to restrict suppliers going through the SOC supplier review process, and the list of restricted suppliers must be submitted to the Treasury concurrently and then give NT 14 days to object. Here I am referring the members to paragraph 6 of the instruction 3 of 2021-22, where it gives the process of restricting suppliers, and it is a process that is fair, open, transparent, and giving the supplier a chance to defend himself, and the process then to follow that in consultation with NT that the supplier will be restricted or not. What we need to take into consideration here, Chairperson, is that it is important for us to appreciate the impact that such a restriction will have on suppliers, in that once restricted, they won't be able to do business with all other government institutions, and not only with that SOC. So once they are restricted, the rules of natural justice needs to be complied with when limiting a supplier's right to trade with government. It may be that a supplier is performing very well in one government institution and for some reason not performing well with another. So if one SOC then restricts a supplier, it restricts that company in its entirety to do business with government. So if we look at this instruction, it is applicable to all national, provincial government, constitutional institutions, the PFMA Schedule 2 and 3 public entities, and it was very important for us to formulate this provision in a matter that provides for a fair and transparent process for the restriction and it to be endorsed on a public register. So SOCs, in conjunction with their legal services, can consider including in their tender conditions a provision which then stipulates that the SOC reserves the right to reject the bid and or any current or future bids within the SOC where the bidder committed a corrupt or fraudulent act in competing for a particular bid or any other bid within the SOC, or cancel any contract awarded to the supplier if the supplier then committed corrupt or fraudulent activities or acts during the bidding process or in the execution of the contract. The fourth challenge was that the preferential procurement regulations only allows negotiations to achieve a market-related price, and that comes from the Triple PFA Implementation Guide, Section 1910. They say the challenge is that the preferential procurement regulations do not allow for competitive post-tender negotiations, which may result in organs of state paying a premium for goods and services, and that historical prices that are inflated can have a huge impact on cost. SOCs is undertaking major savings initiatives, and this will lever will support that. So SOCs would like to be able to allow for competitive negotiations in a fair and transparent manner. Negotiations should be allowed where a market-related price has been achieved so that the SOC can achieve the most optimal price and value for money. They can report then on the negotiated savings, and they want us to change or to make changes in the PPR to allow for negotiations through exemption. Chair, in this case, the triple PFA prescribes that awards be made based on the price and the preference points scored in accordance with the formula prescribed in the regulations. Therefore, the negotiations referred to in the PPR 2017 is directly related to the achievement of market-related prices in order to ensure that any premium which may be payable for preferential procurement as a result of the application of the preference point system is not exorbitant. So there is a provision in the PPRs to negotiate prices. Furthermore, it must also be noted now that the Constitutional Court judgment that was handed down on the 16th of February, declaring the PPR 2017 invalid, new draft preferential procurement regulations have been developed which exclude the provision relating to negotiations, as these now may be provided for in the policies of the institutions or regulated in terms of the PFMA prescripts. The fifth challenge also relates to the preferential procurement regulations that talks to entities' approval for second cancellation of tenders. Again, here we are saying that with a judgment that was handed down and the new draft procurement regulations that have been developed, which excludes this provision for the approval of second cancellations, as these may now be provided for in the institution's SEM policies. Another one on the preferential procurement regulations relates to bid evaluation criteria, where they say that the current evaluation process does not take technical competence into account, and that all suppliers who pass the minimum functionality level are scored against 90-10 scoring principles, and this can result in losses from poor performance and can be in many instances outweigh the contract value. The SOCs are proposing to develop evaluation criteria that must include independent third parties that are not conflicted in the bid specification and evaluation committees, and that SOCs are allowed a concession to apply an evaluation matrix that takes functionality into account in the final award, for example, 40% price, 40% functionality, and 20% BE. In the triple PFA, it states that only acceptable tenders may be evaluated in terms of price and preference, and that an acceptable tender is defined as any tender which in all respects complies with the specification. That the definition of an acceptable tender is a tender in which complies in all respects with the specification and conditions of the tender as set out in the tender document. So therefore, competence should be tested in the specifications and conditions of the tender as set out by the SOC in their respective tender documents. In other words, it is incumbent upon the SOC to ensure that the functionality threshold is appropriately set by the SOC and suitable evaluation criteria that will achieve the result of acceptable tenders being evaluated in terms of the price and preferences that are included in the tender documents. We must also bring to the attention of the committee that the preference point system that are prescribed in the Act and cannot be changed by SOCs, and are further, and we are further reminding the members of the Sizabonke civils case on the issue of adding points of full functionality to the points for price and preference. In a lot of these cases, Chairperson, it's more about interpretation and maybe not understanding how evaluation of functionality works. But that's just a general statement. With regard to instruction note 2 that talks to irregular expenditure, the irregular expenditure framework, the challenge was that condemnations must be taken to the National Treasury irrespective of the materiality or value, and that NT makes a decision on the suitability of disciplinary consequence management that is applied, and it cannot be removed until NT condones it. And also the legacy of historical expenditure as a result of state capture continues to hamper the achievement of unqualified audit opinions on the annual financial statements. The proposal was to institute some appropriate thresholds for condemnation approvals to be within the delegation of the accounting authority, and that irregular expenditure should be reportable in the annual report of the SOC and not a requirement for the reporting in the annual financial statements. The impact on the balance sheet of the SOCs and the ability to then source financing has been detrimental to the SOCs as a result. Chair, this is more an accounting principle. So our Office of the Accountant General are the experts in this field, but their input to us on this specific challenge was that it is a legislative requirement in terms of Section 55(2)(b) of the PFMA that states that annual reports and financial statements must include the particulars as listed in subsections 1, 2, and 3, which is material losses through criminal conduct, irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, as well as any criminal or disciplinary steps taken as a consequence of the losses, irregular expenditure or fruitless and wasteful expenditure, as well as any losses recovered or written off. Subsection 1 in Treasury Regulation 28.2.1 states that these highlighted bits must be disclosed as a note to the annual financial statement of the entity. They did, however, relate to me that they are looking at the revision of the irregular expenditure and fruitless and wasteful expenditure prescripts. They have drafted a new framework, but that still must be consulted, apparently. But in the long term, they are looking at the amendment of the PFMA or Treasury regulations and to review the definitions of irregular expenditure and fruitless and wasteful expenditure to cater for minor and major transgressions. In the short term, until it is revised, SOCs have Section 92 of the PFMA to request for exemption from these requirements. They are also looking at amending the framework itself to allow for disclosure in the annual report. They're looking at redefining the relevant authority to condone the irregular expenditure. They're re-looking at the condemnation framework as it is currently contained in the irregular expenditure framework. And if irregular expenditure is not condoned by the relevant treasury, the accounting officer can remove that from the balance in the financial statement, as is currently the provision in the current irregular expenditure framework. When they do remove it, though, they have to comply to certain elements that must be adhered to. As well, and the last one is the reduction of historical balances in the annual financial statements by keeping the details in the annual report. And number 8 is the e-auction platform that they are requesting that systems be developed to allow for reverse auctions in line with Section 217 of the Constitution. This is definitely something that the National Treasury is considering as part of the modernization and automation initiatives. So that's not off the table. Then there's also number 9, the geographical set-asides or local contracts, where they are saying that the opportunity for SOCs to set aside work for local to site tenders, and the community's expectation in terms of local to site opportunities for procurement, and sometimes that results in industrial action and property damage. The SOCs are proposing that they must be able to identify commodities and services that qualify for local to site considerations. Example, SAFCO and the procurement of milk. So in terms of the triple PFA, an organ of state must determine and implement their preferential procurement policy in terms of the framework set out in Section 2 of the triple PFA. Section 2 states that a preference point system must be followed. Therefore, in terms of the triple PFA, there is no specific provision for set-asides based on geographic location. At the best, points may be awarded to enterprises based in a certain geographic location if this condition is incorporated into the tender documents as a specific goal. These goals were, however, abandoned in the PPR of 2011 in favor of the triple BEE ratings, and that continued into the PPR of 2017. The PPR 2017 has now been handed down in the court judgment as invalid, and in the new draft regulations that were drafted, we no longer provide for the triple BEE status level of contributor as a means to score preference points, but have reverted back to the specific goals as provided for in Section 22.1 of the Act, and locality may form part of the RDP goals as mentioned above, and consequently points may be allocated for it. The 10th challenge is the directive that was issued for publishing and closing of bids during the festive season. They are saying that this specific directive makes it procedurally unfair to advertise, publish, and close bids during the period of 16 December to 7 January, and it makes operations very challenging, example generation, and that the directive stipulating that this is procedurally unfair will result in irregular expenditure, and that they are proposing that they should be able to do procurement where needed for operations without being irregular, and define criteria for such instances. We have to also make clear to the members that this directive, or let me first say that this has always been a practice in government not to advertise over the festive season for the reason that most companies are closed over that period. But it has never been an instruction. It is not an instruction issued in terms of the PFMA, Section 76(4)C. It is merely advice that is provided to institutions, and it is because due to abuse of tenders being issued during this time when most companies cannot respond. So again, we are saying that it's advice cautioning institutions that by advertising over that period, they may be breaching one of the pillars of the five that the Constitution requires. So procurement over the festive season must abide by these principles of the Constitution. It must be noted that the institution may invite tenders over this period, but the decision to do so must be justifiable and not due to poor planning or failure to implement the procurement plans, because procurement activities and procurement plans do get planned a year in advance. So they would be able to plan for tenders and over that period of time. The second last challenge, Chairperson, is the use of the Central Supplier Database. The SOCs are saying that the information is not verified, and therefore the SOCs must still verify the information, and that the CSD, that the products or services listed in the CSD do not match the requirements for technical nature of the business, and that verification must still be done through transaction. The SOCs propose that they maintain their own internal supplier database, where the prerequisite supplier checks and verifications are done for the stated products that suppliers can offer, and allow sourcing of critical components for a closed supplier list of pre-approved suppliers. The database will be maintained by the SOC, and the suppliers can apply for registration at any point, and that the database can be subjected to NTE's verification at any point in time. So the main purpose, or the main reason why the CSD was implemented, was to simplify doing business with the state and to reduce the administrative compliance burden for both suppliers and the buyers. The Central Supplier Database is not there to verify skills and capabilities. It verifies administrative compliance, such as tax status, BEE ratings. It contains the banking details of suppliers, and it is not there to take away the function of the department or the SOC to still look at the due diligence and the technical aspects of the supplier's capabilities. So again, it comes back to how the technical specifications are written, and it must be written in such a way that the selection criteria should be based on specific requirements for the bid, and in order to then attract the most appropriate suppliers from the services that you want to bid for. The other thing is that if it is critical components, there are procurement methods that can be employed, like the establishment of panels of service providers through an open tender process for a period of time, where you have then a panel of service providers that can be contacted and can immediately then service your work that you need to have done. Chair, the last challenge would be the definition of emergency as per instruction note 3 of 2016-17. They say that the definition of emergency procurement does not cover the real situations of operational contingencies, such as the breakdown of power units or locomotives resulting in production losses, security and supply, or loss of income, and that they want a SOC definition of emergency procurement to be agreed upon, and that the accounting authority of the SOC should have the authority to do emergency procurement based on the wider definition of emergency to include the threat to security of supply. And again, Chair, this is a definition that had to be written in the wider context, because it is impossible to write an emergency definition in terms of a particular organ of state's procurement activities and their mandate that they need to deliver on. So it then becomes incumbent upon the accounting authority to determine what in their situation and their institution will constitute an emergency, and to determine the parameters in which emergency procurement may then be undertaken, and in the proper delegation of authority to approve such emergency procurements. So this is something that can be included.
Yes, sorry, can you try to summarize, because I'm looking at the time.
Yes, this is the... Thank you. Yeah. This is the last slide. Thank you.
Okay.
It is important then for accounting officers to consider the nature of the commodities they procure, as well as the service delivery objectives, to ensure that it adequately provides for emergency procurement, and that this emergency procurement should not be used for induced emergency or self-inflicted emergency as a result of poor planning and their procurement activities and the risks which may materialize when implementing their strategic objectives. So, Chair, that is the 12 legislative challenges that they pose to us. And within our current legislative framework, as well as any new ones, we have tried to answer most of the proposals. And I think to a large extent, it was covered by the repealing of the old instruction note 3 and the issuance of the new instruction note 3, as well as the new triple PFA regulations that has been sent out for comment and is currently being considered. Thank you, Chair. We will take questions now.
Okay. You just hold on. We will give the Department of Trade and Industry Competition to make the presentation, and then so that we engage both the reports at the same time. Can you just hold there? Can we go to the Department of Trade and Industry Competition to make their presentation?
Good morning, Honourable Chair, and good morning to all of the Honourable members, colleagues, and everyone on the platform. Honourable Chair, thank you so much for inviting the DTIC to be part of this discussion. As Honourable members will know, localization and the use of state procurement as a industrial policy tool is something that is really fundamental to our economic policy. Honorable Chair, if I can introduce the delegation from DTIC, we've got Dr. Tebogo Makube, who's our Chief Director, Industrial Procurement. We've got Ms. Thandi Pele, who's our Chief Director for Capital Equipment and Metals. We've got the COO of our Industrial and Competitiveness Division, Dr. Annalene Chetty. We've got Mahendra Shanmugan, who is our Director, Primary Metals and Construction at the department. We have Siraj Naidu and Tsolo Mushis from our ministry. And we also have Mr. Jacob Mafuta, who is from our broad-based Black Economic Empowerment Unit. So we have a full delegation, Honorable Chair, which would cover both the industrial policy side, the potential for state procurement to be used for industrial policy objectives, as well as colleagues who are in the sectors that are directly affected by the decisions of SOC. Honorable Chair, with your...
I'm losing you. Maybe it's because they were putting this light on the... Can you come? I think we have lost here. We have lost Mr. Stephen Hannibal. Yes.
My name is Tebogo Makube. In the absence of Mr. Hannibal, who was introducing the team, I think he was about to announce that the person will be making the presentation. So without any waste of time, I'm requesting that, you know, we proceed and he will join when he's available.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
All right, thank you very much. Good morning, Chair and honorable members, including colleagues. The presentation of the DTIC will, you know, try to then advance the debate on what is the issue. We'll focus more on the you know, our role in the whole preferential procurement policy debate. The DTIC in the main is responsible for localization or the implementation of the local content policy, stroke industrialization, as well as the BBBE policy. So our presentation today will focus on those issues, and including the challenges faced by Transnet and Eskom in particular. So the reason why we play a role in the public procurement arena is that government expenditure as a percentage of GDP is critical. So in South Africa, it's about 21-22%, depending on a particular year. So if we then look at what we spend on goods and services, and we take out the money that we spend on the wages, we come to on average 15% on government expenditure that is spent on goods and services, and that is procurement. And we are of the view that we can strategically utilize that expenditure to support economic restructuring and recovery, which emphasizes on on industrialization through localization. The economic reconstruction and recovery plan also attempts to reduce the proportion of imports of goods and services in South Africa. It focuses on the improvement of the efficiencies by local producers so that they can, you know, competitively participate in the global market through exports. So looking then at the government procurement levers that we have in achieving our industrialization goals, we have the National Industrial Participation Program, which is currently being applied at Eskom as well as Transnet. It was used in the past mainly to support the aerospace industry. As you know, the NIP, it's applicable where our imported content is $10 million or above. So, and it's mostly focused on the goods which we don't manufacture in South Africa. So for instance, if you buy a fleet of aircraft or you lease a fleet of aircraft by SAA, so we don't manufacture commercial aircraft at that scale in South Africa. So we are applying a NIP and, you know, global companies like Airbus and Boeing were then implementing NIP and including some of the projects done by Danel and AMSCO, where, you know, when we procure vessels, we then apply, you know, these levers, including NIP. We do have DIP as well, which is managed by AMSCO, and the financial threshold there is about $2 million. So anything from $10 million and above, we jointly manage with AMSCO. So it becomes both NIP and DIP. And as I've said, we do have vessels, which we are currently manufacturing on behalf of the Army, and we are applying these procurement levers. So the Competitive Supplier Development Program was applied by GPE, but I think in 2020, there was a directive from Minister Gordhan that Eskom and Transnet must cease to implement the CSDP and implement NIP. So that's why I've said that initially that we do have projects now that we are registering under NIP and mainly coming from Eskom, and also the projects now with the maintenance of Kuberg, we do have projects which we have registered under NIP. And so designation and local content, local production, I'll talk later about the challenges that has been brought about by the judgment in the Constitutional Court judgment, which has declared the preferential procurement regulations invalid, but those regulations were empowering provisions legally for us as government to then implement localization or local content stroke designation in some of the products which are procured by the government. We also have RIP, which is the renewable energy, where we are also applying localization measures. As you know, we have a special purpose vehicles or the IPP office, which is managing mostly the RIP projects. But what we are seeing is that municipalities, especially metros, will be also playing big in this space. So there'll be a procurement of new technologies to support, you know, the green economy. So, you know, we have a choice as government whether we'll rely more on imports or support our own companies to play a role in the renewable energy space. We also have the local procurement accord at NEDLAC, because most of the levers that are applicable in government, you'll find that private sector is not obliged legally so to implement some of the measures. So we have agreed at NEDLAC that, you know, through the local procurement accord, business, labor and government have committed themselves to buy locally manufactured products. What we have seen also is that through the ESCOM and Transnet, they've committed themselves through their policy positions that they will support industrialization and localization. So see there that there is a roadmap issued by ESCOM in 2019 and also through the integrated report in 2021, where ESCOM has committed itself to buy locally manufactured products, including Transnet, which is gone further to even indicate that, you know, it will implement the enterprise and supplier development programs as part of developing emerging suppliers, because that is key. Now, the legislative requirements governing public procurement in South Africa, we go back to the Constitution, because that's the supreme or the apex law in the country, and 217 is basically the section dealing with public procurement. And the first one, 217.1, it addresses the cardinal principles of procurement, which is fairness, equity, transparency, competitiveness, and cost effectiveness. The view is that this might seem simplistic, but we know that in reality they are not. You know, companies collude in their bids, and thus making their tenders less competitive. You know, so it means from a context of public procurement, that is not only anti-competitive, but it's also unconstitutional, because the Constitution requires procurement to be competitive. And also, it's not only the bidders, we have also seen that some of the specifications can be written in a manner that it affects competition and transparency. So those are other issues that we have to deal with. But Section 217.2 also requires that organs of state, you know, when they procure, they must develop their procurement policies, one requiring for categories of preference in the allocation of contracts, and number two is about the advancements of persons disadvantaged by unfair discrimination. So that is taken to be Black people. So those are the constitutional requirements. You need to have preference in the allocation of contracts and advancements of people. So Section 217.3 requires that there must be a national legislation which prescribes for the advancement or the achievement of the categories of preference and also the advancements of people. So, and that is the triple PSA, which also covers that. But since the judgment, you know, we have seen that organs of state, including ESCOM and Transnet, have approached the National Treasury to be exempted from the triple PSA in order to use their own policies to then develop their procurement policies and you know, procure goods and services. So what it means is that the organs of state, including ESCOM and Transnet, have been exempted from the triple PSA. So in essence, we have the Constitution, the triple PSA, and this exemption. So if then the organs of state have been exempted from the triple PSA, the legislation that is available is the Constitution, and the Constitution is very clear on what needs to be done around preference and the advancement of people. No organ of state legally can be exempted from the Constitution. So we have to implement the constitutional requirement. It can be exempted from the other statutes, but not the Constitution, because we are, all of us, you know, organs of state, so being created by the by the statutes as well. So what we have seen then is that organs of state, have, particularly Transnet, have developed their own policies, you know, based the SCM policies. Transnet, ESCOM has indicated as well that that is the route that it will be taking. Now, from a macro economic point of view, this might facilitate procurement to happen. But the issue is that, you know, there is a danger that we might not have uniformity and conformity in the application of the FCM policies. So it depends on what a particular organ of state will be doing. So that is the challenge. And also, if you deal with industrialization and manufacturing, they're about scale. You know, it's about economies of scale. So if we have this fragmentation in the application of the procurement policy in the country, then we are going to be affected to support in using public procurement to support industrial development. So that we need to, you know, take into consideration. So this slide is more or less, you know, just indicating what I've said, that especially the last bullet point there, that, you know, now both ESCOM and Transnet, they can use their own SCM policies. And it depends on the what the board approves or not, you know, and they've been given this exemption. So we don't have the legislative lever that we can say whether Transnet or ESCOM are doing the right thing or not. Currently, as we are sitting here, the legislative mandate is lacking. So what we have been, we know that as we are implementing industrial policy, we rely on various instruments, which are shown there. But the focus for today is on local procurement. And the reason why we link local content and industrial policy objectives is that we want to leverage public expenditure for capital expenditure as well as operational expenditure. We want to support local manufacturing capacity. It's good economically because we will be expanding the tax base, which is good for the fiscus. There are other multipliers. We also employ people. We want to support innovation and technological development, create jobs, boost exports, and support broader economic empowerment and through the creation of black industrialists, because transformation is also key in public expenditure. It is a constitutional mandate. So this is just to show you what we have done through the preferential procurement regulation. Since 2011, we have been able to designate certain products. We started the first one, you can see the third column there, in 2012. So the first seven products in 2012, we've been able to issue the instruction notes. So, and over the years, we have added certain products for local production. And the last one being cement, and it was designated in November last year. So if you interpret the law and the judgment, all these products are now out. Because the view and Treasury has approached the Constitutional Court to clarify the judgment. What we are seeing from other organs of states, they are indicating that because of the judgment, they are dropping the procurement of these products as part of a legislative requirement. And our view is that that is the wrong interpretation of the judgment. The judgment didn't say that cannot buy locally manufactured products. It said the instrument, which was the preferential procurement regulation, was not appropriate. Organs of state can use their own preferential procurement policies to still continue buying locally manufactured products. But now the challenge, as I've said, others have been exempted from the triple PSA. There's no conformity. There is no uniformity in the application and the support of this product. So, but we are engaging some organs of state. So in the transport sector, which is key for rail, the autos, the ships, and the aerospace. So South Africa is mainly because of our autos program. Our importation of transport equipment is relatively high. So localization was put in place to stop or to limit this kind of importation, particularly in the rail sector. As we know that, you know, our organs of state in this sector, Transnet, Prasa, as well as the Gautrain, they are buying rolling stock and some components. Now, without the support for localization, we'll be relying more on imports. And those imports are displacing some of the manufacturers in the country. Now we are in a very difficult situation in the absence of legislation. But then we have to go to the board in those entities to try and convince them that this is the right thing to do. But if they don't do that, then we are going to perpetuate the economic challenges that we are having in the country. So it is important that we have the legislation that will then direct the organs of state to you know, as they buy the vessels and so forth, to implement local content. So I'm just showing you what we have been doing in minimizing the importation of transport equipment. There was an issue raised in the presentation by DPE that these local content measures sometimes are difficult to be reached by local manufacturers. So what we have done in all the instruction notes or the circulars issued by the National Treasury, there is a section dealing with exemption where a designated product cannot be manufactured in South Africa. We do grant exemption, and some of the exemptions are based on the specifications, designs, standards, materials, technological choices, and other factors. So, and we are mindful that some of the, you know, standards and specifications can be abused in order to drive for an exemption. We have had situations where, you know, organs of state will use foreign standards, you know, to prescribe in their tenders the kind of materials that they want, and therefore certain bidders will come to us to request for an exemption, and we review each and every application. If the material is available in the country, we don't grant that exemption. But if it's not available, we are obliged by law then to then grant an exemption. So embedded in our localization program is the exemption process, you know, to make sure that we don't delay service delivery. So I just wanted to raise that. This slide also shows that, you know, specifications sometimes are abused, and in certain instances they specify specific brands, meaning that we are invariably you know, favoring one particular service provider, you know. And also the lead time in which to come to the market. Sometimes we see organs of they delay to advertise and also to adjudicate tenders. In certain instances, by the time they come to the market, it's on an agent basis, and they want exemptions from the procurement levers. So that is the challenge which we are requesting for an intervention, so that, you know, we are able to organs of state to issue the demand plan, so that the industry out there can prepare themselves for the tenders which are forthcoming. The other issue is the performance bond, you know, and this affects mostly emerging suppliers, because some of the performance bonds needed for guarantees are highly inflated, and as a result, mostly PE companies are unable to raise the funds for performance bonds, which creates a problem. I've spoken about the plans and the agent procurement, which sometimes it's unfair in the market, because we are also being asked to grant for exemption, because most of the things are agent, and it's an area which we are developing procurement policies, we have to seriously look at this matter. With regard to ESCOM, obviously there are other related issues which are not necessarily procurement related. The pricing agreements by the energy intensive users. So our view is that it should not necessarily support particular companies, but it should be industry-wide, because the energy prices and reliability affect industrialization in South Africa. There is another issue around crime. We are working with SARS and also law enforcement officers to deal with economic sabotage, particularly the stealing of cables and so forth, which affects the reliability of supply. And also there are web teams looking at the scrap matters, the export of scrap, which it's directly linked to economic sabotage, particularly the stealing of cables. For Transnet, it's also about rail, freight rail. There is now an indication that there's going to be private sector participation. Now, the challenge is that, you know, is the private sector going to be subjected to the same preferential procurement legislation, you know, because if we have then Transnet, which is subjected to localization requirements, and some of the private players are not subjected to the same market conditions, that has been raised as an issue, which, you know, as we are reforming procurement, we have to consider the container ports, the issue of technology. The ports generally are a problem in terms of the costs and service delivery there. We are working with DPE, with Transnet on around making sure that the cost of doing business around the ports is minimized. And broadly also, it's about localization of the rail tracks, locomotives, the rolling stock manufacturing. We are having ongoing discussions with ESCOM, with Transnet, given the changes in the legislative environment regarding public procurement. And lastly, it's about the scrap matter, which is the same, more or less same problem, which ESCOM is also facing around the rail tracks, which are being stolen. So we are engaging with the organs of state, as I've indicated. We have engaged this week with Transnet. We are going to have other meetings. We are engaging again with ESCOM, you know, on both NIP and local content in the absence of the empowering legislative provisions. So what we are requesting from the committee is that, you know, we must have a broader view of what the judgment is all about. It's very clear the judgment, it was mainly on the ultra vires case that the minister really extended his powers by regulating on the issues of preferential procurement. But that does not necessarily mean that the support for localization and industrialization falls off. We asking the portfolio committee broadly, including other committees, to grant, provide direction that, you know, allow us as government, including working with the National Treasury, to consider other legal avenues to support local content and BBBE policies. Those are constitutional mandates. You know, the issue of preference. You can grant preference on industrial development, on economic development, on rural development. So it's an issue that we still have to define as government, as what the constitution requires us to do. And also, it is important that, you know, we work together as with the National Treasury, including DPE, so that we engage other organs of state in implementing the government policy objectives as well as the constitutional requirements. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. Honorable members, those are the two presentations we've got. I will rather suggest that we start as accordingly. But I will just ask honorable members to check if because I'm anticipating a serious challenge with my gadget. Can somebody in the meantime, I can suggest one person to just continue chairing while I'm still dealing with those problems that I'm having. Can I ask the Honorable Gumede to take the questions according to the list of all members? So that every member can get an opportunity to seek clarity or ask questions or perhaps comment all of the members while I'm still dealing with my situation here. Honorable Gumede.
Chair. Hello, Chair.
Yes, I hear you.
Yes. If procedurally that is accepted, yes, I may fill in the gap. I will request Disang to guide us on the on these aspects, so that we don't leave any gap, which in fact may begin to nullify the meeting. May I request through you, Chair, whilst we are still there, that Disang guides us, that is that appropriate, that as you have nominated, I continue sharing.
Yeah, we can get that from Disang, but according to the rules, the committee, which is the portfolio committee, can nominate a person among ourselves. But when the person is to chair the entire meeting, but I don't know if a person is going to take just half of or just few minutes of the time, and then I will be back to continue chairing. But if the members feel that they have the right to elect somebody, they can do that.
Mr. Gumede?
Yes, Chair.
The arrangement is procedural. The chair can nominate somebody to continue with the chairing while he's still in the meeting, but he's busy with something else. So unlike if the meeting started and the chair was not here, we would have elected the person to chair. So procedurally, you are correct. You may continue.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you very much, Chair. I hope the boats won't be bigger than perhaps my size. And thank you very much for the two presentations that have been given to the committee. They leave much really to be desired. But may I comment, members, that I've seen the participants. We've got 50 participants. And unfortunately, we've got only 9 members of the committee. So the rest, it could be that there are some other members. I know others are simply alternate the attendance other than those that are not well. I heard that the whip is not well. But we may try and get the mechanism that members do attend. My second comment is this is a very important engagement. In fact, it does not require, from my own understanding, a 1 to 2 hour engagement or engagements. It requires a little bit longer because it talks about the issues of procurement, localization, and industrialization. And the other factor that is, in fact, weakening us is that at times documents are coming very late and we don't reach to internalize and ask penetrating questions. We just read and browse the document and at times don't ask the telling questions. But I'm hoping that since the PPFA is about to be finalized, I'm hoping when it is finalized and approved, we will once again have the engagement of this nature. I will then ask members to ask questions. I'll go according to this order because these are the members that one can see on the screen. I'll afford Honorable Mkhwanazi the first opportunity, followed by Honorable Kachalia. Then it will be Honorable Dlamini, comes Maotwe, comes Honorable Piri, comes Honorable Isaac. I'm not sure whether Komane is present or not present.
Chair, Honorable Chair, sorry to disrupt. I request not to be given a chance to question due to my condition. Chair, I check your WhatsApp. Thanks.
No, you'll simply say pass. That's understood. But mine is to accommodate each and everyone. I did not unfortunately get that message. But anyway, now I understand that you may not be available to participate. But if other members are not participating, they may simply say pass or covered or whichever matter that a member may raise. And then the last person will be Malinga. I've seen Malinga is present. And then we conclude it that way. So may I then afford Honorable Mkhwanazi?
Don't meet me. I will be one of the people to ask questions.
Oh, we are present.
Put me on the list. Yes.
Right. I will then put Malinga after Honorable Maudwe, and then put you after Komane, if Komane is present, not unless if she is not present, you'll then come after Honorable Isaac. Right. But I'll still remind you. Okay. May I then, Honorable Mkhwanazi, shoot.
Thanks, Chairperson. Please allow me not to open my video. Chairperson, I want to take from what you have started with to say, I think, okay, firstly, let me acknowledge and accept and welcome the presentations. And I want to follow on what you have started with in your remarks to say, let's make this presentation as an ongoing discussions in our portfolio committee, solely because they are very important. Secondly, maybe part of it is the late arrival of some documents. But more for me, Chairperson, is that we've been, as the portfolio committee, discussing the issue of this procurement for a long time. But Chair, I want to check with I didn't see whether the DPE is present, but I will shoot anyway. But I want to understand, especially on the Denel side, that has as the DPE having an engagement, especially with the National Treasury, on the issue of a Denel, of the issue of a Denel issue, because I think in our last meeting and in our oversight, a period, we as a committee, we really emphasize on that matter. I want to check the progress around that matter. Lastly, for me, Chair, from the last meeting when we were in the meeting with the DPE in our oversight in the DPE offices, we did discuss the issue of the lesson learned and the issue of the proactive strategic plan going forward in dealing with all SOEs that especially that are within the portfolio of DPE. So I want to check through these requirements of the PFMA, what DPE assisting Transnet and Eskom, and also Denel, especially on the issue of reinforcing some of the finances or some of the conditions or some of the assistance from the DPE. That will be all for me, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mkhwanazi. Let's go to Honorable Kachalia.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, National Treasury's proposals within the current framework aim to ameliorate impediments, and as such, are welcome. Mindful of these and the need to comply constitutionally, particularly in view of the recent Constitutional Court judgment, and in view of the fact that we are facing a crisis at Eskom and a looming one at Transnet, number one, should we not investigate reliance on the Companies Act versus the PFMA, also to cover increasing private sector involvement, which is aimed to assist these SOEs to re-emerge sustainably? Two, should SOEs not procure, as the Constitution lays out, in accordance with the principles of fairness, equitability, transparency, competitiveness, and cost effectiveness alone? This requires clarity as to what can be included and excluded. This is a very important point, which I don't think we are addressing fully here. And thirdly, would this not require a revision of the bid criteria to reflect this, particularly the BEE component, which has created many cost and operational issues, to put it mildly, by cross-application of BEE and competency and cost-effectiveness issues. Now, with regard to the DTIC's presentation, localization and industrialization are government policies. Their wisdom aside, they seek, in terms of procurement, to advance developmental policies in these key and seriously challenged SOEs that are currently, as I said, in crisis mode. So the question is, surely we should be addressing the current issues and needs and requirements that are needed to stabilize these entities, particularly ESCOM and Transnet, and then revisit these policies and the applicability thereof. It will also provide us time, will it not, for the provision of data as to how industrialization and localization has fared and what the pertinent options are to sustainably provide public goods and ensure that SOEs are stable and profitable in the first instance, without which they will continue to be a drain on the fiscus and require massive ongoing bailouts that in itself will negate the policy imperatives that the DTIC is positing. Now, finally, cutting across both of these, whatever happens, we have to comply with the Constitution. That is a fact. And the court's findings. And it is clear that there are divergent views on the judgment and its application. Therefore, I'm requesting, can we have a legal opinion on the implications of the Constitutional Court's findings so that we can be clear on what is required constitutionally with specific reference to procurement, section 2172 to section 2173 and other gray areas, insofar as they are bound to comply, as I've said, with the requirements of fairness, equitability, transparency, competitiveness, and cost effectiveness. Nothing else is mentioned. Those are the only ones that are mentioned. Any failure to do this may open us to legal contestation. I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Kachalia. The next person, please.
Thanks, Chair. Morning, colleagues. This is one of the rare occasions where I find myself having to agree with some of Honorable Kachalia's sentiments. I do believe we do need to get a proper legal opinion on the court judgment, among other reasons being that you would remember that in terms of our constitution, it allows a government to pass legislation which deviates from the Equality Clause for purposes of redress, which is what I believe would have been part of the reason why you had this piece of legislation in the first place. So we need to also find that legal opinion in terms of how does the judgment affect this piece of legislation and the purpose it was created for. The other issue I want to speak to is this of localization vis-a-vis industrialization when it comes to local content. You will appreciate that ESCOM and Transnet, in part, they are more especially ESCOM. ESCOM is an engineering company. They should be able to locally deal with the bulk of the challenges that we have. And we are somehow not doing that. You would also understand that Transnet has an engineering company, wing, Transnet Engineering, which currently is the largest employer of engineers in terms of their staff complement nationally. We need to also look at how are we using these skills, if we are using them adequately or not, and how does this fit into the local procurement and localization debate. You would remember, Chair, that we used to have ESCO, which produced the bulk of steel that we used for our rail networks, but we don't have that anymore. There's a plant right here in the Western Cape close to Saldanha Bay. It's deserted. There's no productivity happening there. And now that you are going to have to deal with the issue of rail being stolen, we will have to look at how do we source steel. Most probably we'll import from Australia or some other country. But we do have the capacity to produce. Maybe it's not there anymore, but it used to be there. Now, we need to remember the previous parliament had started a process to review and evaluate if the laws that are being passed serve their purpose. I'm not too sure if that has been fallen by the wayside or it's still a discussion on the table. Because had we had that discussion concluded and had the findings of that type of an inquiry, it would help us to discuss this better from an informed point of view, factoring a whole lot of issues. Remember, there are some critics of this public procurement, preferential procurement framework in terms of it being competitive, whether it's fair or not. There are too many debates for and against, but because ultimately it boils down to price, and it doesn't create space for emerging contractors in the greater scheme of things, because ultimately they will compete with the well-established companies on price, because the 80-20-90-10 really doesn't cover much. That's the one argument. But it's an ongoing debate. I think, Chair, I will stop there. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Dlamini, for your contribution. Let's go to Honourable Maube. Honourable Maude, are you there? Allow me then to go to Honourable Malinga.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Greetings to yourself, members of the Portfolio Committee, and all presenters on the platform, Secretariat from Parliament, and everybody else. Chairperson, I think Honourable Dlamini has covered me on the issue of the court judgment. Chair, I just want to check, man, Guti, how do we lose such court bids when we have the state attorney? Because I'd like to believe SOEs, government departments, when they pass the legislation or any bill, the state attorney has to be involved, come on board, and advise whether this bill will fly or not. That is my first question, Chair. The second one, Chair, I think I got one. Maybe I should start by apologizing that I logged in late. We are being load reduced. It's not load shedding, Chair. This thing is that is done by municipalities called load reduction. So I was suffering from that. The first presenter that was presenting on challenges on procurement, I think she presented something like emergency procurement. I think she was on advertising in December. I did not get clear, Chairperson, clear explanation on what is emergency procurement. Take, for example, a municipality, there is a pipe burst, and municipal employees cannot fix that pipe. They need to procure. Do they consider that an emergency procurement? Because the reasons given for not advertising bids in December is that companies are closed and all that and all that. Can they consider that an emergency when maybe there is a pipe burst at the municipal level which supplies water to the community and all that, and maybe that municipality does not have the expertise skill? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Thank you very much, Honorable Malinga. May we go to Honorable Isaac? Honorable Isaac?
Chairperson, hi, good morning. Thank you. Chairperson, I've been covered by the previous question, so I will not want to duplicate it, but I thank you for the opportunity. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. May we go to Honorable Komani? Honorable Komani? If not present, then we go to the real chair, Honorable Magaka.
Thank you, Honorable Jefferson. Perhaps I would like to take the presenters to the main objective, where we come from actually with this whole issue. Though Honorable Gumede and Honorable Kashalia tried to cover me, let me also add the real reason that make us as members of this community to be concerned is more to do with the state-owned entities, especially those that are under the Department of Public Enterprise. And we feel very strong that central to their collapse, these entities, is precisely because of the, I don't want to say the poor because it's not there, the lack of considering the importance of public partnership. I think that's what we feel very strong, that it has contributing factor on the state of these entities. These entities are not working as they are supposed to do, while they are all supposed to be the state-owned entities. But when it comes to their operation, they operate as if they are totally independent and with no particular objective. I'm sorry. The CEO, the GCO of Transnet mentioned in the last meeting that Transnet was discouraged from using the CSIR directly and was forced to go on a competitive bid process. And also the main cause of these failures to us exactly is around those issues. That is because the entities are operating on silos. They are operating as if they are not having a common objective. For example, the DINEL as an advanced manufacturing and industrial capabilities. However, the state departments are unable to leverage on such capabilities due to competition laws. And that's also our problem. The procurement processes are not compelling any state-owned entities to procure from the state-owned entities, while they are state-owned entities. The spirit or the conscience of a developmental state of advancing public partnership is not there. The second example is Transnet Engineering. It has the capability to manufacture trains. However, we continue going abroad for plaza-related needs. You know, those are the problems that we have. Why can't the state-owned entities collaborate to advance the developmental objective of the state? Are we still building this state capacity for a development state, or do we operate to advance global capital to benefit at our detriment as a South African state? What is really happening here? Those are the main objectives of us having to call the
the Department of Trade and Industry Corporation to help us to understand really whether are we really interested to build the capacity of these entities, or we also, in a way, because corruption took place there, therefore they have to die. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think I've exhausted the list I have. Before I'm taking it back to the presenters, may I then ask a few questions, if it's not comments. The presenter, Tebogo, has spoken about the exemptions as well as the uniformity. I completely, perhaps I'll say, I'm worried about the exemptions as well as the possible lack of uniformity, especially all what this is doing when the triple PFA was declared invalid. My understanding is it started bringing in a scenario where there was a kind of a distribution of powers, and entities were given the authority to a degree the SOEs or SOCs were in fact even given the right to kind of object. But Deboche says, if there is a challenge because of that exemption, the Constitution is there. I just want to make one reference to that. These SOEs were looted seriously. Many of them, if not all, they are just crawling. The Constitution was there. If the Constitution were saying that is supreme, no one can do anything different to the Constitution, then it will mean those people that looted wouldn't have done anything wrong against the Constitution. Moreover, if you read the state capture report, it tells you that many of the executives and some of the board members were the engineers of the state looting. And some of the things we may perhaps take them very light. And it's possible as well that some other people who still further the objectives of the state capture are part of the executives, if not still members of the board. So I'll be happy. I'm not sure how are we going to reverse a situation when the act is passed and all things go back and everyone follow the act, rather than those powers are left with all those different people, which in fact will bring that lack of uniformity as you have articulated. There is secondly this I'm sure that it was in the absence of the triple PF that the accounting officer was the one who was going to have the supreme authority. But I heard Astella, yes, I think it was the presenter. In fact, there was a little bit of a concern that the national national treasury, in fact, from me, from what I read, was going to get the information after the march, right? When all things have happened, there is no way that some of the things could be properly scrutinized. But I wanted just to ask, who could be or who is this accounting officer? It could be any person from the SOEs, or it could be any other. If I may be perhaps enlightened, who is the accounting officer in this instance? Not unless we talk to the powers that may be, but those are my concerns in the presentations that have been forwarded. Thank you very much for that. May I then give it back to the presenters. But I've noted as well a comment made I can't remember, that in fact, if the department is present, would they like to comment now before we give the presenters the opportunity to respond, or they would like to make comments? Oh, it was you, Chair, that made that comment.
I also did, Chair Mkhwanazi.
Yeah, thank you very much.
The comment from the department.
Yes.
Thank you.
So please then, may we get at least a comment? It's either they come at the end or they come before the presenters. We would like to hear them saying something about this kind of a situation. I think Honorable Jamini has narrated some of these things, which are, in fact, all of us, in fact, we have said very sensitive things here, which, in fact, are saying we need to come closer to the situation so that we understand. The assertion by Honorable Mkhwanazi that we need to meet much more often on matters of this nature is in fact a fact. So we rely on the Sang, the Chair, and perhaps the Whip to make sure that these things are brought to us so that we digest and be in a position to strengthen our oversight as the committee. So if ever there is anyone from the department, from the DPE, may I get a comment from them, whether they will come at the end or they would like to come in now. They may chip in now, that's still fine, or they can come at the end. But being the principal of the whole thing, they must say, even if it means coffee, that will be excellent to us. So may I get a comment from them, please?
A chair from the National Treasury. When I went through the comments that were made, a lot of them were statements. But in connection with Ms. Malinga's question around emergency procurement and the definition thereof, and what about burst pipes around the period of the closure of businesses over the festive period. The definition of emergency procurement, and I'm just going to read it verbatim. Emergency situation means a serious and unexpected situation that poses an immediate risk to life, health, property, or environment, which calls for urgent action, and there is insufficient time to follow a competitive bidding process. So in this case, the example that was mentioned about a burst pipe in the middle of December will definitely be compliant to the definition of emergency. So So we should not confuse emergency with not issuing open competitive bids during the festive period. What we are saying is that emergency can happen anytime, and the accounting officer makes that decision depending on the severity of the emergency, where it is going to have an impact on risk, health, life, property, or the environment, and where there's not enough time to issue a bid. The issue about cautioning departments not to issue new tenders for which was planned over that period is that we have seen over the years that tenders that were issued during that period, and it closes, say, for example, on the 7th, and the company only opens on the 8th, they would have missed that tender. And then there's a whole legal battle for not being able to tender during that period because companies were closed and they did not see the tender going out over that period of time. So it's more a caution, but it shouldn't be confused with what emergency procurement is. Emergency procurement is totally different and separate and under very specific circumstances that happens. Then in terms of who the accounting officers are or the accounting authorities, by Mr. Gumede, Honorable Mr. Gumede, in terms, and I think maybe Leander can help me here, if I'm not correct, accounting officers are usually the heads of departments, the director generals of a department, provincial or national. And in terms of public entities, the accounting authority would be the board. And Leander, just help me, Archer, is it also the CEO of the company?
Colleagues. Yes, it's the board. The accounting authority is the board, and that's what the PFMA speaks to in terms of public entities. But sometimes what they may do is delegate some responsibilities to the CEO. But in terms of, so there's a distinction between accounting officers, and that's in the departments, government departments, but in your entities, we talk to accounting authorities, and that's whom the power is usually vested in. But it doesn't mean that they cannot delegate in accordance with their delegation framework. Thanks, colleagues.
Yes. So in order, the proposals that the SOCs made in most cases is that they want to quarterly report on these issues of deviations, expansions, and extensions of contracts, where we are asking that if in cases of deviations, it be reported within 14 days after the transaction. And with regards to variations on existing orders, on existing contracts, that they report that monthly so that we can proactively intervene where we are seeing clear malfeasance or clear misunderstanding of prescripts or whatever the case may be. Chair, I didn't see any other specific questions unless I didn't understand it. To me, it was more statements that were made and not questions to be answered. Unless I see Leander's got her hand up, maybe she can add.
If I may, through you, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. I just wanted to also, I think, agree with what some of the members have been saying regarding the time frame and the time constraints in terms of this meeting, because I do think that issues, it would have been nice. I think Treasury in our presentation did refer to the judgment, but didn't really get the opportunity to reflect on our understanding of it, because I think whilst it was a lengthy judgment, there are some very pointed paragraphs which tend to indicate the reasoning of the court. And I think it's because of that reasoning as well that even the draft regulations went the way they did. But I think it must never be confused or you know, with the fact that as a treasury, we don't believe that the judgment has thrown out certain issues, you know, regarding, for example, protection and advancement of categories of persons who were previously disadvantaged by unfair discrimination, or has thrown out the concept of local production and content. What the judge merely was saying, and that's again, I think, just talking to the comment, I think, by it might have been Honourable Malinga as well, about, you know, sort of how do we lose judgments when they are state attorneys, etc. And I think, you know, the reality is sometimes as many lawyers as there are in a room, there would be different opinions. And the same actually even happened with the judgment. You'll notice that it was a 4-5 split. So even the judges at the constitutional court level disagreed in terms of their view of that. But except to say that for a long way into the judgment, they actually agreed with each other, except on the pivotal point where they said that they don't believe the impugned regulations to be going against the Constitution. All that they said was because of what Section 2.1 of the Triple PFA says, it was not the minister's place to make those regulations. So, and hence, even looking at, because regulations are subordinate legislation to the Act, it would then be important that the regulations cannot introduce provisions that are not provided for in the Act. So what the judges were saying is that if the minister felt that institutions are not doing what they're supposed to do, it wasn't his place to take away their right and make law on their, make policy on their behalf. What he should do is look at other legally cognizable means to achieve the same goal. And that is to possibly looking at changing the legislation. So, and I must also acknowledge that indeed the Triple PFA has been found to be somewhat of an impediment to meaningful transformation. And that is why there's the development of the Public Procurement Bill that's underway, to look at a menu of options and a more meaningful way to give effect to some of these things. But in the meantime, as long as the Triple PFA is still law, so it was not the Triple PFA that was declared invalid, it was the preferential procurement regulations made thereunder. So as long as that is still law, in the meantime, the regulations have to then match with that. So I think it was just that point. And in terms of the Constitution, just lastly, the Constitution, as Dr. Makube said, is the supreme law of the land. And the Constitution does provide for those five principles, but it also says, you know, notwithstanding subsection 1, nothing prevents an organ of state from implementing a policy, you know, that refers to categories of preference and your protection and advancement. But the challenge is that even in the Constitution, it constrained the way in which institutions may implement those that preference policy by saying that national legislation must prescribe the framework. So in other words, that policy that institutions apply has to be applied in the context of national legislation. So where the national legislation does not exist, it would be, that is the difficulty. How do organs of state then apply that? And that is why in the meantime, while National Treasury is getting clarity from the Constitutional Court, and while institutions have been granted exemptions so that they can continue their service delivery requirements, one of the other mechanisms at least that they can consider in implementing their policy is what is contained in the BEE legislation in Section 10. And so even when the judgment was given, the BEE Commission did issue a statement saying that they are not affected by the judgment in terms of preferential because that is a separate legislation, and rightly so. It's governed separately, and so they can then, and they've indicated that they will assist institutions in terms of, you know, how they can apply that in the meantime. So I just wanted to add those comments. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members.
I'm not sure whether is it Miss or Madam Estella finished her contributions. But yes, I think that she did say some of the things that in fact were commended or asked in her section. She has responded to it. The only one was about the finalization of the PPPFA. When is it going to be finalized, decided, and then when do you think you may necessarily come back to us so that at least we get a bite of it? But whilst we are still there, let's then give Mr. Deboho an opportunity then to comment. Thank you very much for the Linda. Thank you very much for highlighting, because our understanding is that it was declared in Pelly. The understanding was it was the whole act, but it's an element of the act that was in fact declared, or it could have been declared invalid on the basis of that portion. But in the nutshell, not the whole act was in fact declared invalid. Thank you very much for that explanation. Can I then go to Mr. Deboho?
Thanks, sir. Try to answer some of the questions raised, and I'll ask my colleagues to add, especially Ms. Pelle, on the work that we are doing in the rail sector. Our questions raised on the exemptions, and the committee, maybe just to explain to you that sometimes we use words interchangeably, you know, and we have tried working with the National Treasurer to explain what exemption means. So the exemption that is covered in the presentation relates to the lowering of minimum thresholds for local content. So in a case where bidders cannot meet the minimum threshold for local production. So let's say the army is buying uniform, all right, and there is a particular fabric that cannot be met or cannot be manufactured in South Africa. So the minimum threshold for uniforms is 100%, meaning we do not allow for the importation of the uniforms or any other products in that case. So, but there are instances where, for security reasons, you know, certain fabrics cannot be manufactured in South Africa. So the procedure is that bidders must approach the DTIC for exemption to import those materials. So that is one, you know, definition of exemption is in the context of local content. We have been trying to change the word, you know, to be specific, that we relate to the lowering of minimum threshold, local content. Then there is another form of deviation or exemption, which is the responsibility of the National Treasurer, where for particular reasons, okay, so state can approach the Minister of Finance to be exempted from the requirements of the PPPFA. That is, I think, if I'm not mistaken, is it Section 5, the under assist of the PPPFA. That was happening.
Section 3.
Section 3.
Section 3, right? Yes.
Yes. That was happening before this judgment. Now, after this judgment, I know that the organs of state then are approaching the National Treasury to be exempted from the PPPFA in order to continue procuring goods and services. And that's where I'm putting in the dangers of non-conformity and non-uniformity in the procurement system All right. So that's the risk. And I think, is it Member Malinga who has raised the issue that because we have quite a number of organs of state, the risk is that each and everyone will decide on how to go to the market and how to allocate the contracts. So we have history of corruption in this country. So the need for legislation is for conformity as well as compliance and uniformity. So in the period that we find ourselves in, that's the risk we are having up until we come up with either another legislation or regulations to make sure that there is conformity in the system. That's one issue. And I think moving forward, Chair, I'm now addressing the issue of public partnerships that has been raised by the chair of the committee. It is true that, you know, there is a limitation. And the proper way to do it is that the legislation must address the deviation in the context of organs of state procuring from each other. All right. Currently, if you interpret the law, is that the procurement system must be competitive, and the Constitution requires it that way. So if you then decide to procure from other organ of state without following the legislation, then you'll be transgressing that legislation. But then as government, it is important that we address that issue, either through maybe a section dealing with derogations, you know, on the basis of security, on the basis of public interest, that therefore organs of state can be empowered to procure from each other. But now it is a challenge. It's not only in the rail sector. I mean, there is a contradiction previously. When SAA was in operations as public servants, we have been traveling to various countries or regions within the country. You know, the way you buy tickets, it must be competitive, you know, so you can fly using another airline. But at the end of the day, we use the fiscal to bail out SAA, you know, so it's a contradiction from a public finance point of view. Now, that's why you need derogations, you know, from other associated legislation that the Competition Act or the Competition Policy in order to protect the capability of the organs of state. And I'm hoping that in the new legislation, the Public Procurement Bill will have sections dealing with derogations from the competition requirement, because it's not always desirable to always follow competition to the latter. It is a standard practice to allow sections dealing with derogations, especially for security reasons. I mean, in Europe it's allowed, in the US it's allowed. So I agree that we have to deal with that, including confinement. You know, we need legislation on confining tenders so that you don't always go to the market, even though you know that there are other organs of state that can be capable of providing the service. Obviously, it must be at an affordable price. Yeah, so those are the issues that I've noted. I'll ask Tandi to come in, if possible, on the rail issues.
Thanks, Dr. Makube. And through you, Chair, it's Tandi Taylor from the DTIC. I think I'm partly covered by the response from Deboho that says, in some strategic procurement in government, we have to be selective and purposeful on how we want to create the capacity to locally manufacture. I think Honorable Member speaks of the capacity that has been created over time in Transnet Engineering that we stand the risk of losing because of lack of sufficient demand to feed into the production line that we have built. Honorable Members would recall, as part of the locomotive program, there was a part of packages that were dedicated towards Transnet Engineering. that really has assisted us to really create capabilities, in particularly in Goodisport, a little bit in the Devon facility. Transnet Engineering continues to be, an OEM in a work on build and maintenance. And to the extent that we were able to really collaborate on the process new trains, I think we could have been able to create sufficient economies of scale that would have anchored the developments into passenger trains going forward. Although we have to acknowledge that at the back of the process procurement, they have built a state-of-the-art facility at Donato that is managed by the Kibela Consortium, which is really building the local the new trains in housing and really bringing in a lot of localization from a component level. But yes, I do agree, and I think this is the point that Deboho made earlier on when he was presenting, that in some strategic procurements or fleets, we need scale, we need consistent demand in order to get the price right and be able to really develop these capabilities locally. So often many of the SOCs, maybe to manage risks, they procure on an individual basis, and that does not really allow us to really standardize on the technologies and be able to really develop suppliers locally of scale that can really be a new frontier of our export our competitiveness. So, yes, there's a lot of room for a number of SOCs to collaborate, especially on common systems and components that they are buying, so that we are able to really create the right level of production skills to justify some of the new investments that needs to be made in the domestic market to support both the build and the maintenance programs. And I think this is a lesson that we ought to be learning as we are talking about the Just Energy Transition program, where we want to be procuring a number of transmission lines to connect the renewable energy generation that we are currently buying from the various IPPs. And secondly, how we're going to be buying the IPPs going forward. For me, I think there's a lot of room where some standardization and synergizing what the bidders are bringing to the South African market can be consolidated in order to create a more equitable way of localizing, because we still need to get the price right. We need to ensure that we produce products of the right quality. And for us to be able to do that, scale is of importance to be dealing with some of the issues. So yes, indeed, collaboration is needed. And I think I'm hoping that the colleagues from the DPE can really talk and give us some guidance on how can we work better together. I think we've got pockets where the partnership has really worked, but I think it requires a lot of scaling up and this to be a strategic thrust on how we're really developing capabilities going forward. Thanks, Dr. Makubeni. Thanks, Chair, for the indulgence.
Thanks, Chair.
From you, Dr. Makube, is there anyone that wants to contribute from your side?
It's Stephen. Or anyone from the DTIC?
Chair, if I can come in?
Yes, please do.
Thanks very much, Chair. Chair, just very briefly to respond to the questions and comments from Honourable Kachalia. Chair, when we engage with manufacturers in South Africa, our sense from them is that there's a great level of confidence about their ability to compete and to provide products to the South African consumer, to state departments, to organs of state, at good prices, competitive prices, and of good quality. And so for us, Chair, what we find interesting is that if you think back to the World Cup in 2010, none of the buses that were used in the World Cup were actually produced in South Africa. Even though we had the capability to produce them, they were not designated at the time. We didn't have a policy lever to force organs of state to buy local. By the time the Rea Vaya bus systems were being introduced, we had actually designated buses. And so many of the buses that you now see on the roads, whether it's in Cape Town, whether it's in Gauteng, those Rea Vaya buses are in many cases made locally. So we can produce many of the things that we consume and that the state buys, whether that's vaccines. Aspen in Kibeha is now producing Africa's first COVID-19 vaccine. Whether it's anesthetics, whether it's autos, where the Mercedes-Benz C-Class is one of only three production sites is actually in South Africa. And we export the vehicles throughout the world. So in many cases, we have the capability to produce these products. Sometimes we don't have the right tools to ensure that as government we procure them. And for us, the real issue is if we want to address the 1.9% GDP growth that's forecast for 2022, or we want to address the over 40% unemployment rate, then we have to start procuring what we use from local manufacturers so that we create the local jobs. Otherwise, every time we procure something that we import, we're simply exporting that job to China or to India or to the United States or the European Union. So it needs a slightly different approach to seeing state procurement as an important lever for local economic development, whether that's in Kibeha, whether it's in Gauteng, but we're able to produce these goods. We just need state procurement to help us to ensure that we do buy them locally. So I thought that was important just to make the point, Chair, because I think also Honorable Dlamini had asked the question about what is the role of localization and industrialization. And, you know, he alluded to Eskom. As members will know, we're on bid window number 6 at the moment for the renewable energy partnership program. And the question is, we're going to procure around about 45 to 50 billion rands worth of solar panels over the next few years. Now, we can either procure them locally from the two large solar manufacturers that we have operating in the country who have created jobs in South Africa, created investment in South Africa, or we can simply import them from a range of developed countries and developing countries like, again, China, India, Germany. And for us, the argument is that if we want to create the jobs locally, then we have to use all of the policy levers available to us to ensure that we buy local, because we can produce the goods. It's a matter of making sure that we put in place all of the policy instruments to really unlock those opportunities. So that's all from my side, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Stephen. You know what we are doing? Our weakness as government, our communication is very weak. We don't communicate enough some of the things. We simply take them for granted that the people will know. I don't think that's a correct perception. All what we need to do, you say it and you say it repeatedly so that people will know. If you've got those excellent kind of initiatives, that's what I think it's Mkhwanazi that was talking about, Dinel, as well as Transnet. They've got all those capabilities. They've got all the experienced engineers. Why do, especially with Dinel, because there is this that we want to retain some of the expertise within Dinel. Why can't we borrow some of these engineers, let them go work there? Because if they are just idling, they won't in fact be in a position to demonstrate the skills that they are having. But all what I'm saying here, yes, we hear you, but as government, let's make sure that we communicate and communicate enough that some other people may get saturated of those things. I know when we've got our own meeting as a committee, there are people that are very strong on industrialization. They always ask industrialization. So those are things that, in fact, the good things, you don't keep quiet about them. At times, yes, bad, you may talk about them, not as much as you may talk about good things. But anyway, thanks for that comment. Otherwise, if no one from the department, may I then allow all... Yes?
We have Mr. Bangani from Public Enterprises. His hand is up.
Oh, no, I don't see the hand. Okay, that's fine. Mr. Bangani, you may come through.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon to the honourable members, colleagues on the call. Look, from the Department of Public Enterprises, I think we were the first to approach the committee somewhere in March to indicate the challenges around the procurement space. If you look at DPE, because of the SOCs, the issue of conforming with the procurement policies is one, and then also using the same procurement policies as levers to drive industrialization. It's at the center of what we're doing in with regard to procurement. Conformance with the policy and leveraging the policies to drive policy. And the issue of the SOC in particular, the issue of irregular and irregular expenditure. Let me just use irregular expenditure in this case. In the area of conformance, tends to be a big issue when things are not fully clarified, where the audit outcomes tend to influence the outlook in terms of how the market is going to price them in terms of when they go into borrow money in the market. So their audit records tend to be affected. So we want to conform with the policy, but we needed help in that area to say, how do we deal with legacy issues that continuously reflect in the books of the SOCs? So that's one part in terms of as we clarify the procurement policies. How do we sort of protect the SOCs going forward so that the issue of 10 years ago does not continuously affect the outlook for the SOC. But on the leveraging side in terms of industrialization, actually we as a DPE we are working very hard to make sure that the SOC are part and parcel of this journey of localization and industrialization. The issue of developing local suppliers that can be embedded in the relationship with the SOC going into the future. But not only that, to also develop them to such an extent that they can independently supply to other markets locally and abroad. So supplier development as part of leveraging the procurement levers to support industrialization. And in fact, also, bringing people who were excluded before in the supplier development process program, the issue of people with disability, the people, women-owned business, youth-owned businesses, those are some of the things that we're trying to drive through
the procurement what's called levers. So it's at the center of what we're doing in the area of industrial and or localization and industrialization. It's critical from the point of view of DPE. So the issue of on the issue of Danel, when I read the brief earlier, the issue of designation of ammunition and small arms in particular, that's a very critical issue because we have the capacity both at Danel and in the private private companies locally that can produce small arms. They can produce Danel can produce small ammunition, but the fact that it's competitiveness, fair price, so we tend to be buying from all over the world, affecting our own capacity, which is now at a subcritical level as we speak. So the National Defense Industry Council, which is chaired by the Secretary for Defense, has a subcommittee that is looking at that is collating the information that's required to approach the DTIC and National Treasury to designate small arms and ammunition as items that can be or that should be procured locally. So there is an effort from that point of view to get things localized from a defense point of view. You see the issue of using imported products versus local products. It must also be seen from the point of affordability for the state. I mean, if you're going to maintain your Transnet, for example, system, the Transnet system through a dollar-based maintenance system, it's not affordable. As far as possible, the maintenance budget for these SOCs should be in rand terms. Then the affordability is somewhat managed from that point of view. But if we're going to not protect the economy by always using dollars to service the infrastructure, it's going to be a huge challenge going forward. So, Chair, this conversation is quite very important from the DPU point of view, and we agree that it should be a continuous conversation as we refine, as we look into clarifying the system of procurement and simplifying it for everyone to understand it the same way we all want it to be understood. So it's a very important conversation, Chair, and DPE will gladly be a very interested partner in this conversation. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you for your presentation and comment. At least we can solidly say DPE was leading or is leading, whatever. But at least because you came in, Bangane, and you represented the DPE, that's wonderful for us to get that. Okay, Bangane was, I see a hand here. I'm not sure whether it's a legacy hand. Oh no, now it's going. Okay, let's then, because we're about at the tail end of our meeting, before...
Hand up.
Is there anyone that wants to speak?
Yes, Chair, I have my hand up.
Yebo?
I have my hand up, Chair.
Yes. I'm listening.
Okay. Chair, questions which remain unanswered and need addressing. One is on the procuring of an independent and impartial legal opinion. So the question is, how and when can we move on this? And if we can move on it. And second is on the need to address the current crisis in our SOEs in line with the Constitutional Court's finding in terms of procurement, which will assist these SOEs to manage the crisis they face as a first priority. Now, with regard to policies for localization and industrialization, will the Constitution still, the question is, will the Constitution, the considerations still be in line with the Constitutional Court's precepts based on the five pillars? Now, this also underscores the need for informed clarity on the court's rulings to resolve views which are currently at variance, especially with other aspects of the Constitution's applicability to this. Now, of course, there are divergences of views, but there's no way around this. The court makes a ruling. If there is divergence of views, the only way to deal with that is to get legal clarity impartially and independently to assess that with a view to ensuring that we don't open ourselves to legal challenges. So that's what I'm pushing and pressing for. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a legacy hand. Drop your hand then, Honorable Kachali. We have a commitment at 1 o'clock. So please, can I allow anyone to try and respond to those outstanding questions? And then we go to the minutes, and then we come with the way forward. Please, is there anyone who can respond on the questions that were omitted, raised by Honorable Kachalia?
Yeah, it's Taboho.
Yes.
Let me attempt to answer on the question pertaining to the legality of local content policies or localization. I must state up front that local content per se was never litigated, even in the original case, you know, by AfriForum or now Sakilika. It is unfortunately affected for the reasons that the Constitutional Court said that the entire regulations are invalid. And so if you read Regulation 8 or Section 8 of the 2017 regulations, then that is on local content. And therefore, it's unfortunate that the empowering provision to support localization is also out because of that judgment. Now, the issue is, how do we then move forward? You know, and the court is very clear that the responsibility to implement preferential procurement policy resides with organs of state. You know, as it is now, we don't have this empowering provision legally. One option is then for us to engage the organs of state to implement local content through their SCM policies. Now, we have read the Constitution, the PPPFA, as well as the regulations, what we wanted. So if you read the PPPFA, Section 21D of the PPPFA requires organs of state to, or it says that it may, organs of state may invoke the RDP goals, all right? So that is there in the PPPFA. Now, the RDP is not theoretically different from the National Development Plan, meaning that we want to scale up economic growth and also transform the economy. And it is our view that the legislation does provide the space for the government to still continue implementing localization using the triple PFA, and that is section 2.1, all right? And also, if I think it's section, I'll tell you now, there's a section in the triple PFA that is section 2E. It also states that organs of state can indicate any other specific goal that it wants to achieve in the tenders, all right? So that is another opportunity of specifying any other specific goal, and it can be local production, you know? So there is legislation. Where it becomes a problem is when the organs of state are being then exempted from the triple PFA. That's where the gap, the policy gap is, because then we rely more on the SCM policies. So procedurally, it means that organs of state must adopt the SCM policies and include those conditions to support local production. And as the DTIC, we do have a legal opinion. We sought a legal opinion on this. And obviously, we must follow all the protocols if it has to be shared. The minister must give an approval. But the policy space to still continue supporting local production is there. The court didn't make any ruling whatsoever that local content and industrialization are unlawful. Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Debs. Let's then say, because I want to release you now, but the I think all of us who have expressed a sentiment that we need to be closer to you so that whatever is happening, we are closer, and whatever is updated and your engagements with the SOCs, those are the things that we are saying we want to sort of keep them flying, so that we always try and do the right thing, push it, and get the right information, so that at least we get some SOEs perhaps moving, perhaps in the right direction. May I then suggest as a way forward that from here, I want to give it to the secretary, that the secretary, through the interaction with the DPE, because Bangani was around, it's difficult to say Bangani interact. It's better that I go via the secretary, who in fact will interact with the department, and then whatever transpires, because there are a few things that they have been raised, so that we see as a committee, when next do we want to meet with you? But it mustn't be the committee or the department. Even on your side, if there are things that you may wish or want to share with us, we are always welcoming and open to say, let's have a session and talk about these things. It's a real concern. I must say our weakness as SOEs, in fact, one can simply say, are destroying the country. So if jointly we can really try and solidify that and make sure that we create a concrete path that will see all the SOEs mushrooming, doing the work that are skilled for, I think all of us and even the country will be happy. So from today, for this meeting interact with Disang, who in fact will interact with the get the mandate from the DPE, and then we kind of move forward. Thank you very much for your input. It was very much informative, and it left us with quite a lot of heavy head, in a sense. So we'll see when we come next as to how we move further. I think all officials will then be released, but Disang will remain behind because we'll be considering some minutes, and then we close the meeting. Disang, may I then hand it over to you? But all others are
Chair.
Then set free.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Thank you very much to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Disang?
Thank you very much. I've only got one set of minutes. It's the minutes of the 18th. Why is it dealing with me now? Okay. Is it clear, Chair?
Hey, nothing is clear here. You, the first one, but it hasn't been. You've got a list of minutes, yes, highlighting the 18th, but not the minutes.
Okay. It should be clear now.
That's fine, yes.
Yeah. Sorry for the delay. It's just the meeting that adopted the budget board report that took place on the 18th of May, 2022. These are the members who were present, and the apologies, including staff that was present, opening remarks, and then the consideration of the draft budget board report. Within the inclusion of the objection from the Economic Freedom Fighters and the Democratic Alliance, and then the amendments that were made by the members of parliament. Number three basically deals with the draft minutes that we also adopted on that particular day. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. May I have a mover and a second, please?
Thanks, Chair. It's Honorable Mpanazi. I move for the adoption of the minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any seconder?
Honorable Dlamini seconds the motion.
Thank you very much, Honorable Dlamini. Having completed items that appear on the agenda, may I be allowed to then adjourn the meeting for further deliberation at our next meeting. The meeting then stands adjourned. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you. Have a safe day, a wonderful day. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mbuni.
Chair, have a nice trip. Whatever you'll be doing, please do remember us.
Recording stopped.